Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guest we're delighted to have on the podcast is Jeff Paredes, who is the Assistant Professor in the Department of Pediatrics in Baylor College of Medicine. So, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. And we're delighted to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Colin and Daniel. Really appreciate it.
You have an extraordinary kind of a route to your current position. Can you tell us something about that? Because in another life, maybe you'd still be studying physics. So how did that come about, and how did you reach where you are now?
Yes, physics was just a really strong academic interest going way back. I had some wonderful teachers in high school, and I just really enjoyed understanding simple things like if one throws a ball at a certain angle and a certain speed, being able to predict exactly where that ball is going to drop. And I guess it really shaped my curiosity for understanding how things work. And from there, I figured, well, what better curious organism to study and wonder about than the human body, and especially development of the human body. And so from Harvard, I moved to Houston, Texas, and joined the medical scientist training program, earned MD and PhD degrees at Baylor College of Medicine. And from there, I stayed in Houston and I completed a residency in pediatrics and a fellowship in pediatric gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition. And so now I serve as a pediatric gastroenterologist, where I spend most of my clinical time in the neonatal intensive care unit as a consultant to help manage the liver and gastrointestinal problems that are associated with extreme prematurity. And at the same time, I run a basic and translational research lab where we are trying to understand how nutritional insults, mainly malnutrition, very early in life, disrupt liver function, disrupt gut function, and especially we're looking at the microbial-derived factors, some of the microbial metabolites that mediate crosstalk between all of these organs.
And so that's a fascinating change of career. And to me, it seems, maybe I'm wrong, you correct me, but it seems like medicine is one of the least predictable fields of science. And physics is possibly one of the most predictable, at least if you get it right, you know you've got it right. Is that a challenge that you do not know if I do this, the ball will bounce back at a certain angle and the patient will get better? Or is that a frustration, or is that something that exhilarates you or excites you?
It does a little bit of both. It is absolutely frustrating when I have a patient in front of me who has a devastating disease and I don't know exactly how to best treat this patient. But at the same time, it inspires me to get up every single day and learn as much as we can. And the patients I spend the most time taking care of, this is a population of patients that essentially did not exist just a few decades ago. If you were born at 23 weeks in the 1960s or 70s, chances are you were not going to survive. And now that these babies are supported with excellent ventilatory care and other supports from neonatologists, now they're presenting with all of these brand new intestinal feeding, nutritional, and liver problems that we've never thought about treating previously. So I think it's a really exciting time to be in medicine. And I just love what I do every single day.
One of the ways you try to get at how do we know what's going to happen with this very complicated organism, the human, is by doing animal research. And you've been doing remarkable studies in animal research throughout your career. Can you talk a little bit about the relevance of the animal models to the clinical questions that you have to confront and what you'd like to see be done better in those kinds of studies?
animal models certainly have some important uses. For instance, if one is trying to determine whether there may be a causal link between microbiome changes and some sort of clinical phenotype, then they might choose to perform experiments using germ-free mice, for example. So take out the microbiome. Does the phenotype get better, worse, or is that phenotype unchanged? And that can give some really important insights into the potential role of gut microbes in health. But we always have to remember, a mouse is not a human. A piglet is not a human. A non-human primate is not a human. And unfortunately, so many really, really exciting headline-making discoveries from these rather artificial laboratory systems have just not yet translated into actual concrete clinical benefit just yet. And again, that does not mean that there is no link, that no link exists. It just means that we really need to temper our expectations that what happens in mice may or may not also be happening in humans.
And it seems to me, Jeff, that, you know, you talked about surviving at 23 weeks, which is extraordinary, and that this wouldn't have happened short years ago. And so baby is being unplugged from mom, if you like, 17 weeks early, or I hope I've got that right, roughly right. And so the nutritional aspect of that is must be extraordinary, try and meet the needs of the baby. But also, I guess it means that the baby encounters microbes 17 weeks earlier than perhaps developmental biology would have expected that to happen. Do you think that's a big issue for the baby, for the developing immune system, nervous system, and so on?
It certainly could be. And we don't have any concrete proof that this early exposure to microbes is either good or bad. It's really, really difficult. Humans are such variable organisms from one extremely preterm neonate to the next. And we are actively looking for links, for associations between some of these early life colonizers and later health outcomes. But those concrete definitive links remain elusive.
How do you go about clinically deciding whether or not you want to exploit what may be a beneficial but could also be a potentially risky mechanism of exposing the premature infant to probiotics with the hope that that would improve their ability, the health of that infant?
Yeah, these are conversations that we are having on a daily basis with the families of the infants that we are taking care of. So one thing that's important to note is that of the totality of evidence from human trials examining the effectiveness of probiotics in either treating or preventing certain health conditions, and again, none of probiotics are FDA approved to do any of these things, probably the largest body of evidence is emerging from the neonatal intensive care unit. And more than 15,000 preterm infants have been studied in more than 60 randomized placebo-controlled trials to study whether probiotics may prevent some horrific health outcomes. And probably the most dreaded complication of prematurity is a condition called necrotizing enterocolitis, which is an inflammatory condition of the bowel. And mortality rates remain high. Many survivors do require surgical resection of a portion of their bowel, and that can result in short bowel syndrome, and that can result in long-term parenteral nutrition requirements, which can then injure the liver. So this is a really a dreaded complication that occurs in, by the numbers, between 5 to 10% of patients in the neonatal ICU. So this is a real problem. And probiotics, if you look at all of the evidence quantified in meta-analyses, probiotics appear to reduce the risk of necrotizing enterocolitis by about 50%. This is pretty dramatic effects. The evidence, I will say, is controversial. And when I sit down with families, we don't talk so much about the numbers, but I think it is important for them to think about the potential risks. We are administering a live microbe into a very, very fragile, very, very small neonate. And certainly there is a theoretical risk that that live microbe can translocate from the gastrointestinal tract into the bloodstream, resulting in sepsis. Now, I will also point out that most of these randomized controlled trials in the NICU have examined sepsis as one of the primary outcomes. Right along with NEC, sepsis is another one of the dreaded complications of prematurity. And probiotics do not seem to increase the risk of sepsis in these studies. They significantly seem to decrease the risk of NEC, but there is no increased risk of sepsis.
Oh, I would almost say, wouldn't Cochrane suggest that there's evidence that they reduce the risk of sepsis, or am I a little bit out of date?
Many trials do report reduced rates of sepsis, but when you mathematically combine all of the studies into the meta-analyses, we don't see the same strength of evidence that we see in terms of reduced risk of necrotizing enterocolitis.
Okay.
Now, I will also point out, when we have this discussion with the families and we're talking about the safety of these products, there's one case that made a lot of headlines. It was a horrible situation from a children's hospital in Connecticut. And this case was published in October 2014, and it involved a 29-week preterm infant who was born at about 1,400 grams. And this infant was given a probiotic to try to prevent necrotizing enterocolitis, sepsis. And it turned out this baby ended up with a case of disseminated mucormycosis, a fungal infection that ultimately was traced back to the manufacturing process of the particular probiotic that this infant was given. So this was one very alarming case. And again, this is not the live microbe. This is not the probiotic itself that left the GI tract. This was a contamination of that product. So it's a little bit different than typical sepsis, but it certainly raised a lot of eyebrows. And it also highlighted the fact that we do not yet have a pharmaceutical grade product available to give these very, very fragile infants. So although cases like this are few and far between, and again, this is the one case report that really made a lot of headlines, really the overall rate of this sort of event happening is exceedingly low, but it's not zero. Right. And so when we sit down with families, it's really important. we cannot promise that there will be no adverse effects with this product if we choose to use this product for the infant before us.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about what the controversies have to do with? Like, a lot of our listeners would think, well, if you do the clinical trial and it gives you a result, what's controversial about that? But those of us who do studies know that it's not always that straightforward. So,
absolutely. And back in medical school, I was taught the pyramid of evidence when one looks at, you know, whether to really, really trust and invest in data that is presented. At the very bottom, you might have anecdotal evidence, case reports, case series. And at the very top of this pyramid, at the peak level of evidence, would be meta-analyses, systematic reviews and meta-analyses pulled together. And they're supposed to be really the gold standard. But meta-analyses are very tricky, especially in the case of probiotics. So I was part of a team assembled by the American Gastroenterological Association, and we compiled 63 randomized controlled trials involving nearly 16,000 preterm infants. And we mathematically determined that, yes, probiotics seem to reduce the risk of NEC by about 50%. But there are a lot of caveats that go with this mathematical derivation. So these studies involved a very wide range of products. They involved different strains, different doses, different combinations of strains, different durations of treatments. They enrolled very different study populations, even though most were based in a neonatal intensive care unit. Some enrolled extremely preterm, some enrolled very preterm, and some enrolled extremely low birth weight, some enrolled very low birth weight. The inclusion-exclusion criteria were not always the same from study to study. Some studies permitted the use of adjunctive therapies along with the probiotic. And perhaps most importantly, outcome measures were often discordant. And this is something, even the definition of necrotizing enterocolitis, there are multiple stages of this. And even the definitions from one stage to another are debated from one clinician to the next. So there are a lot of issues out there that I think the typical reader of a meta-analysis, and especially the typical reader of a clinical practice guideline that may be issued by a leading medical society, we're all looking at the same body of evidence. But these meta-analyses try to boil down, try to capture all of this into a single number, reduced risk of NEC by about 50%. But in reality, the situation is much, much more complex. And you can drill down even to the level of the individual published trials. And in many cases, when we rigorously evaluate each and every one of those trials, we might find some issues with, for example, was a random sequence generator used to try to assign a patient from one group to the next. And historically, these really important elements of a good clinical study have not always been reported. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting better as a field. But when we sit down as a team to analyze the totality of evidence, we include both well-done, well-executed, well-written trials, as well as those who may have some issues and some potential risk for bias.
Yeah, so, you mentioned something, and it's a little bit subtle, but you correctly said that whether or not a probabilistic mechanism was used for the randomization was not reported. And to evidence-based medicine connoisseurs, that's important whether the investigators knew to report that or not. And that's always interesting to me because I think it's one of those things that a scientist like Colin would think, well, why would I report that? Of course I used a probabilistic mechanism. That goes without saying. But it turns out that it's become established empirically that that's kind of a good telltale sign of whether or not the investigation was done at a high quality. But of course, it could be completely possible that a study generated really good actual evidence in the way that it was actually conducted, but it wasn't reported properly.
Absolutely. And in a perfect world, all 63 of the trials that amount to this large body of evidence, all 63 would be just executed and reported perfectly, and we would have no concerns whatsoever. But that's not the reality. And so I think we need to decide, you know, to what extent are we going to buy into some of these really what appears to be a beneficial effect in terms of a really, really devastating disease for this population. So clearly, all these nuances are not going to go into a typical discussion that clinicians are going to have with, you know, a nervous parent of an extremely preterm infant who, you know, is at risk for a whole lot of really, really devastating things, both now and over the long term. But I think it's just important that we approach this with balance, and we realize that the body of evidence is convincing, but it's far from perfect. And one other issue that constantly comes up, especially in professional societies that recommend against the universal use of probiotics in the NICU, is that safety has not always been reported. And this is really a problem for the entire field. Is, you know, back in the old days, probiotics, one of the terms that was associated with probiotics was GRAS, generally recognized as safe. And we are getting much better as time moves on. And we are now reporting with rigor how many patients in each arm developed adverse events or serious adverse events, and how many patients dropped out and for what reason. But the concern is that some of the evidence that we are analyzing was generated before this awareness of the need to report safety data as rigorously as possible. That was before this new era. So I think we're moving in the right direction, and we have certainly raised awareness of some of these issues. But now we really need to make a decision on what to do. And right now, some of the leading professional societies have issued guidelines that oppose one another in terms of should probiotics be given in this arena.
And in that very confusing scenario, and obviously it's a highly emotional state when you're talking to a parent or parents of a sick child and you're trying to recommend something, how do you choose which probiotic? Obviously, I don't want you to name any particular product, but how do you choose which probiotic from those 63 different trials? What level of evidence do you look for? And has the probiotic that you use changed over the years? Have trials come along that's made you think, oh, actually, maybe I'll switch to this other one?
Yeah, this is a very tough issue. And one approach to choosing one strain of probiotic over any other strain is to turn to a special type of meta-analysis called a network meta-analysis. And this is a study which essentially ranks the possible benefit of one therapy up against another. So even though most of the trials that have been published do not test two probiotic strains head to head against one another, nearly all of these studies enrolls a placebo arm or a no treatment arm in the case of neonates. So one can estimate using this combined control group that we can sort of estimate which product might have greater efficacy than others. Now, one caveat is that the more a particular strain is tested, the stronger the body of evidence. So not surprisingly, filtering towards the top of these network meta-analyses are combinations of bifidobacteria and lactobacilli. They are the most frequently tested, and there is the strongest overall body of evidence that a lactobacillus strain or species and a bifidobacterium species or strain might have benefit. So one can take that approach. We can try to use numbers, knowing that the development of these numbers and statistics is far from perfect. Or one can take the approach, well, maybe we should consider looking at mechanisms by which a particular probiotic may be benefiting this infant. And there is a very interesting preliminary study that was published today in JPGN, the Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition. And some researchers from UC Davis actually looked at two different probiotics and they studied the ability of one of these probiotics, its ability to metabolize human milk oligosaccharides and create a potentially anti-inflammatory environment in the intestine. Now, this was a rather small study that was not designed to look at rates of NEC. It was certainly not powered to do that, but this is the sort of mechanistic work that can help us get past picking the same probiotic that has been used time and time again and essentially selected for historic reasons. Now we can begin moving towards choosing a probiotic based on potential mechanism of action. Now, I will say for the prevention of NEC, this is a somewhat difficult situation because we don't know exactly what causes NEC, but it is thought that anti-inflammatory bacterial properties could potentially benefit these neonates. And so it remains to be seen whether this study might ultimately translate into a probiotic strain that might perform this beneficial function better than some of the others that we have tested previously.
And one might expect, and I assume, of course, it has been tested, that just anti-inflammatories then would have a very successful outcome in babies with NEC. Is that the case?
You know, it remains to be determined. It does not really seem to matter. There are lots of randomized trials that do report a beneficial effect of probiotics. And not every one of these probiotics is specifically known to have anti-inflammatory properties. So it remains to be seen whether this is the one and only mechanism that might benefit this particular patient. I doubt it. I am quite certain there are going to be multiple mechanisms and potentially a multi-strain probiotic that could offer several potential beneficial mechanisms to these infants to protect them from this condition. That may be where we're going years down the road.
Yeah, one of the things I notice as a statistician is when I see an estimate of the potential benefit, you know, a lot of times my colleagues will say the point estimate, like there might be a 50% reduction. The way I think about it is, well, there's a lot of uncertainty in that estimate. So what's the confidence interval? And then is that far enough away from no benefit, like, you know, from being neutral, that I'm pretty comfortable that there's going to be a net benefit. But with Colin and with Jeff, you guys know so much about mechanism that you could look at the same statistical evidence, and because of what you know about lactobacillus and bifidos and what impacts they may have on this or that mechanism in the gut, that could also alter your assessment of things. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, Jeff, you had mentioned long-term impacts on that neonate. Your longer-term research program is really inspiring because you're looking at the impacts of undernutrition and what that can mean, not just for the microbiome, but for other aspects of promoting health and growth in that infant, like the bile acid metabolism and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about what excites you about the research you're doing into mechanism and how what you're learning in, for example, understanding bile acid metabolism might impact what you want to do with your next mechanistic studies in the gut?
Yeah, so there is at this point a very well-studied association between early life undernutrition, and this typically has to happen, we say, within the first 1,000 days from conception till about 2 years of life. If there is a severe nutritional insult during that critical window of development, then the host, the human, is at roughly 8- to 10-fold increased risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other metabolic disorders later in life. And to take a step back and just think about what is going on here, some people have dubbed this the so-called thrifty phenotype, that when nutrients are scarce, the host finds a way to just grab on to every single nutrient that it receives. It grabs on, it stores, it is preparing for, you know, for prolonged famine or fast. And that defense mechanism may help the host, may help that neonate or that child get through that period of extreme nutrient deprivation, but it becomes counterproductive later in life when that child is now an adult who has access to the Western diet. One does not need to continue storing, being thrifty with nutrients. So we don't understand the mechanism of this thrifty phenotype. And if either of us, if any of us did the same sort of nutritional insult at our ages, we would not necessarily see the same thing. There's something that happens during that early developmental window. And we believe that this is based on epigenetics. So we are specifically looking at DNA methylation changes that occur in the liver, for example. We see that transcriptional programming can be altered in a rather long-term way from this early life nutritional insult. So a lot still needs to be understood about this. And especially if we understand how this occurs, what can we do about it? There may not be a whole lot that we can do for a baby who was undernourished in utero, who was extremely growth restricted. But if we can unravel that, what seems to be a long-term epigenetic switch, we might allow that child, once catch-up growth has been achieved, we might be able to reduce the risk of long-term metabolic comorbidities when that child becomes a middle-aged and older adult.
Can you talk a little bit about the epigenetics? Because one of the things that I think a lot of our listeners may not appreciate is that those stresses that the child is exposed to could potentially impact that child when they grow up and their children.
Absolutely. There is emerging evidence now that some of these epigenetic phenomena can be passed from generation to generation. The strongest evidence has been in mouse models. And of course, mice are easier to study because they, you know, their generation time is a lot shorter than humans. But it still remains to be seen how this translates to humans. And again, the main point is, what can we do about this? To try to reduce really one of the greatest health problems on earth today, and that is obesity and its associated metabolic comorbidities.
Jeff, this has been really fascinating. We've run out of time, but I think there's plenty of meat here to come back for another podcast if you're willing to do it. I think the babies of Houston are very, very lucky to have someone so knowledgeable and passionate about their long-term futures and their well-being working on their behalf. So thank you so much for joining us, but thank you for the work you're doing. It's really appreciated.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always fun to chat science with the two of you, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.